Okay. All right. Thank you to all the readers. Thank you very much. My name is Savan. I'm an alcoholic. First of all, I want to thank you so much for inviting us over. I'm grateful. It's an honor and a privilege to be here and to have 10 minutes of your time. So thank you very much for allowing us to be here. Thank you for hospitality. Thank you, Julie, for asking us. Thank you, Suzanne, for the treasure. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Justin. Thank you, Joshua, for reading. Gosh. I'm so thankful. Well, my sobriety date is October 15, 2012. And it's through the grace of God that I'm able to be sober. And I get to have wonderful people like you guys in my life. And it's so much better than where I used to be. So I'm from Fresno, and Fresno is, it's amazing. I have a men's group that I go to. We meet every Tuesday. We study from the big book. My grand sponsor goes there. My sponsees go there, and we read from the literature, we discuss, and we share. And it's a whole different experience from where I used to be, because I'm learning how to fellowship and having a brotherhood where I can be honest and share about. And spirituality is important. Without spirituality, I wouldn't be able to stay sober. I have this connection with a higher power today I never thought I could have. And it's because of my sponsor, working with my sponsee, working with other alcoholics, and it being a part of a moment like this. It makes life so worthwhile, and it's amazing. Money can't buy this. Money can't buy sobriety. Money can't buy the peace that I have. Receive, I get to bury my mom being sober. I get to go through a breakup sober. I get to lose my job sober. I get to laugh, belly laughs. I get to go through a tragedy and know that I'm fully supported by a higher power. That is my new employer, and I get to be his agent. I don't have to be the director of the show anymore. It was a big role for me to play. And I don't have to have that control anymore. It's only when I get into fear, I grasp for that insanity. And the insanity is trying to control people, places, and things to match what I think sees fit. And I'm grateful that I get to have that relief. How it used to be like was that I grew up in a house, very traditional. My mom's Buddhist. And we lost our family members in the war. This is back in the Khmer Rouge time, back in the late 70s. My mom was in the concentration camp, so she had suffered some PTSD. My earliest recollection of her telling me how it used to be like was that when she was starved, she was pregnant with me, and she was in the concentration camp, she stole a handful of rice. And they caught her, and they beat her. They shot her in the shin, and they put her in an underground cell, and it was the triple digits. And I love my mom. This is the woman that gave life to me and gave birth to me during a war. She sacrificed everything she could to bring me to America. My dad stepped on a landmine, and before he died, he told my mom, "You need to go to America and live. I want you to love again. I want you to marry someone." I had no idea what love was. I had no idea what a mother's love could be. And so I worked the steps. She was on my resentment list. And I didn't understand, how could I be so angry at the person that gave me life? I'm so thankful that my sponsor took me through the fourth step. And she was the first person that was on my resentment. I hated her and I loved her at the same time. I was so afraid to come out to her and tell her I was gay. I was so afraid to tell her a lot of stuff about myself. I was so ashamed and so full of guilt. And I just couldn't be that person that I think she wanted me to be. I couldn't live up to an expectation of my own setting. She never set the expectations. It was me, and I held it against her. How could you hold that against your own mother? I remember she sold her gold necklace so she can help pay for my student loan. She knew I wanted to do something with my life when I tried to get sober. She sold her necklace. This is the hard-earned money that she makes. She's disabled. She has arthritis. And she's doing everything she could to put me through school. And I just couldn't stay sober. I couldn't stay sober on my own will. And when I did my fourth step, I'm just going to jump into the solution because it's so important that I talk about the solution. You guys know how to drink. You guys know how to get in trouble. You guys know how to make wreckage. But I'm going to tell you about the solution is that when we got thorough with that fourth step, I didn't leave anything out. Things that I was resentful and deep hurts that I held against the world, people, places, and things, I had to write that shit out because it was eating me. I remember listening to a speaker and he talks about the snake bite. A snake bite doesn't kill you. It's the poison that runs through your veins. It goes to your artery and it destroys you. It's the poison that kills you. I had poison in me and I couldn't remove that. And the only source was my higher power. And I had to identify what was going on inside me. Internally, I didn't know how to write it out. I didn't know what to think of it. There was no clarity at all. And so I wrote it out. I found out that there was expectations that I had set on her. It was unrealistic. My mind was so distorted. It was just unpalatable. It was so hard to take in chunks about myself. Truth about an alcoholic that they don't want to hear about themselves. I had to see it. And there was a lot of praying. There was a lot of asking for direction. There was a lot of meditation, prayer. I had to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And while I was doing that, I had to write it out. And once I shared with another person, with my sponsor, I felt like a free person. I believe that people were put in your people's lives for a reason. Even if I don't like that person, they were put in my life for a reason. And they're a reflection of where I'm at. And my mom was my reflection. I couldn't see how much she loved me because of my anger and resentment. I felt free. The secret wasn't killing me anymore. I had let go. And I get to make amends to her. I get to make a spiritual amends because the day that I was 10 days sober, she died in the hospital room. And I had no idea how powerful God is. I had no idea. She was about 78 pounds. She lost her vision. She couldn't see anymore. My mom had cancer. And she lost all her hair, her beautiful long black hair. I used to run my fingers down her hair and tell her I love her. She didn't have any hair anymore. That woman did not care about her looks. All she cared about was putting her kids through school and making sure that they eat. I prayed. I asked God, please remove this cancer. And he did. I'm so thankful he took her life. I felt this immense freedom. I felt that relief that I don't have to pick up anymore and that the shame doesn't hold me a prisoner anymore. And it's all thankful for people like you guys. You guys are the extension of God. You guys carry the hope. You guys are the one that takes people through the steps and help introduce a God of my understanding, not your understanding, but my understanding. That's a big freedom that I get from making an amends to my mom. It's a freedom, a new happiness, and a new outlook that I never thought that was possible for myself. Myself! I never thought that was possible for someone like me. Living in a garage, the foil is up on the windows, the doors are locked. God damn! You know? Oh, this is so therapeutic. I love that. But this is what I'm talking about. We laugh at the tragedies, and they're not tragedies. They're all experiences. All experiences help me grow. If I'm willing to see that willingness, the honesty, the open-mindedness, I'm willing. I'm willing to see that. I'm willing to grow. I'm willing to have courage, and I'm willing to let go of resentments that I can't harbor. I can't. I just can't do it. Normal people can hold that. But for me, it is poison. It's absolute poison. So one gift that I get to have after my mom had passed away was that I get to be a son. I get to wake up. I do my morning meditation. I ask God to please to direct my thinking towards from self-pity, dishonest, and self-seeking motives so I can be right-sized. And I think about my day, how can I be useful today? How can I be more effective than yesterday? The 10th step is all about effectiveness. It's all about growing. How I see it, the defects are still there. You know, no matter how hard you pray for them to go away, it's just grass. It's just constantly growing. All I get is that I get to grow an inch higher than my grass. And see, that's all I get. I get to look over the fence. It's still there. It is still there. The fence is still there. I get to have the strength given by God to perch up and know my horizon. I get to be a victor than a victim today. I don't have to be a volunteer of any tragedies. I don't have to be that. I get to take people through the steps because this disease is cunning, baffling, and powerful. It will take you, even if you're gay, straight, whatever it is, it will take you. It will take you. I'm so thankful. Julie, thank you for asking us. It's been a great car ride coming over here. We're laughing a lot. You guys get to have a wonderful speaker. This man loves his mom. He loves his family so much. Chip is my hero. We wake up and we pray together. And I'm so thankful that I get to have a best friend like him in my life. Thank you for being my teacher. I love you. Thank you.
Good morning. My name's Tim. I'm an alcoholic. I love this. It's so dramatic. I'm the leader of the party. At the VFW. I guess I ought to qualify. I said I was an alcoholic. I never liked to follow Savon for obvious reasons. I know there's a difference, but I don't want other people to know. Wow, you guys are so different. He's so spiritual and you're so different. I mean, my God, he spoke for 10 minutes. He got a world war, a death, a great American get to America story, a lot of tragedy, and he got sober in the end. And that's, my story is similar in that I get sober in the end. But there are no landmines like in his story. Well, different type I have. Where am I? Well, I'm chewing gum. Why am I chewing gum? Should I put it in the big book? Yeah. All right. I'll leave it here for you. Thank you very much. Okay. Thank you. That's our tech crew. Thank you so much. All right. Thank you so much, like Savon said, for having us. And it's always an honor to be asked to speak anywhere. And we've come all the way from Fresno, willing to go to any lengths to speak. And I've never been to Springville, but it sounds like a nice place. And it does. When I first moved to Fresno, I was like, I don't know, should I go? You know, no is in the title. Fresno, you know. No. But Springville has spring in the title. To me, it sounds like a nicer place. But anyway, it's all relative. I am from Fresno. I stopped being from Los Angeles about 2 years after I moved to Fresno. It took me a while to be precisely where I was, and now I'm from there. If you're new, well, you're new. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Tell me your name once again.
Cherish.
Cherish. What a great name. Yeah, this is a wonderful, wonderful life. You know, sobriety technically may be a noun, but to us it's a verb. You know, it's all about action. And I knew so little before I got here. I did not know I was an alcoholic. I really did not know. I knew my father was. I knew my brother was. I knew what it was. I just somehow
never registered with me. And I don't know how new you are, but when I got here, boy, they say some strange things here, you know? They got slogans on the wall in most of these clubhouses. Easy does it. You know, think, think, think. They tell you not to think too much, but then you see a little sign that says, think, 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 you know. So there's a lot of contrary and stuff. You know, they'll say, don't judge, but stick with the winners. I mean, it's really confusing. You know, well, how do I win at this thing? We got to surrender. So once I have it, how do I keep it? We got to give it away. You know, like, people need to decide what you want me to do. And just, it's very confusing. And the language is strange. And some of the people are even stranger. As I always say, if you like everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous, you're not going to enough meetings, you know. Pick up those meetings. There's going to be, just like in life, there's going to be people that you aren't terribly fond of, you know. That was another thing they said. You don't have to like them. You just have to love them. What in the hell are you people talking about? It was really a different language. And the one thing I knew for sure the moment, and by the way, I started in our sister program, Al-Anon. And you probably heard of that too. I was not in it very long because I was recruited pretty early into this one. But there were two meetings going on simultaneously. And I had a boyfriend in that other meeting, and yeah, he was an alcoholic. And I was in Al-Anon. Now, in Al-Anon at the time, and I don't know much about it, but they taught me the salute, which is, oh, you know. So You'll use it. But from what I could tell is they had identified the problem. Now, you know, and there was a lot of sharing. We call it sharing, but I heard bitching. But it was sharing. And one night, well, the alcoholics would always break simultaneously. No. Differently. And I'm telling you, it was like a bar right outside our window. They were laughing and kind of like that table number 9 over there, you know. It was like, what the hell is going on over there? What are they drinking? Nothing. But man, it kind of pissed us off, you know, because we were trying to identify our problems and recover, and we had these qualifiers out here, you know, having a stinking party. And one night we broke at the same time, and that boyfriend said, "Hey, you should come down and meet some people." And so this was at a place called the Alcoholics Together, VAT Center. And so I came down there and I met one or two people. Everybody was gracious, like here this morning, gracious and warm and wonderful and friendly and inviting. It was a little different from my meeting. And I remember the second person I met saying, "Oh, God, you're an alcoholic," which I thought was a little rude and presumptuous on his part. I'd barely spoken a word, and he had labeled me an alcoholic, which I secretly liked. I kind of liked it, because what I didn't know at the time immediately was that I felt something in that room. I felt the love that people had for each other. There was just a different energy. And I have nothing against Al-Anon. My sister goes there, and I've been there with her. And it's a wonderful program. I've never heard anybody go in there to say, "Oh, what a waste of time that is." You know, a black belt Al-Anon will zero in on you right away before you even speak. They know your deal. They just see right through you. So it's a wonderful recovery program. But I'm an alcoholic. And so I wound up here. And from that day forward, I just kept coming. I knew it was over for me. You know, I didn't want any more of what I had. I wanted whatever you guys had. And so I was like, I'm going there, you know. Now, the laughter, I must tell you, irritated the hell out of me. You know, you come in these rooms and people are just guffawing over stuff. And it's like, I was pretty serious about this thing called life. You know, I had no skills. And
I would hear things like they'd say, you never have to drink or use again. I didn't know I had to drink. But I did. I had to drink because I could not survive this painful process called life. It was just, I just didn't have the skill set and didn't know that. But they were right. And I kept hearing people say, experience strength and hope. Experience strength and hope, you know. Again, all these irritating phrases. And I was just hoping to experience some strength. You know, that's where I was, you know. Just. And people kept coming up to me. Hi, who are you? You know, oh, God, not again. We'd do this little prayer huddle at the end, you know, and once that huddle would break, I'd make a beeline for that door because people always wanted to meet me. And I wanted to just be left alone, you know. First of all, this is a terrible place to come to. Alcoholics Anonymous is not a good place to find single loneliness, you know what I mean? It's just, they just keep asking you questions, you know. And I had made a career out of always being the new guy. I knew how to be the new guy. And I was always the new guy because for a variety of reasons, but I think it was mostly fear of people. I just didn't want to be close to anybody. I was just tired of being disappointed and hurt. Didn't want to do it anymore, you know. I remember talking about defects of character, you know. Envy was new to me. I was not even envious until I was several years sober. I never wanted anything because I was tired of being disappointed. Everything I ever wanted, I never got. So screw it. This business of wanting stuff, forget that. So, not a healthy attitude, but it worked for me. It's the best I could do was never to want anything, you know. I'll tell you, my sobriety date is November 22nd, 1988. And if you're not skilled in the mathematics, that is 29 years and 11 days and a whole bunch of minutes. So, yeah, I just celebrated a birthday. And I do love alcoholics. We are a different breed, you know. I remember I was telling them, people, you know, I'm going to speak in Springville. Oh, where's that? Well, I don't know. I mean, do I have to know, you know? It's the information age, but where's that? You know, I don't know. I'm just, they asked me, I'm going to go. You know, I've learned that, you know. Leap before you look, you know, and I'm going. GPS, just suit up and show up, you know. But it's funny how everybody wants to know, where's that? I don't know. 2 miles north of where Jesus lost his sandals. I don't know. Somewhere. Somewhere, nowhere near here. You know? Would you like to come? No, I just wanted to know. Then you don't really need to know, do you? You are on a need-to-know basis. I find over the years, I try not to ask a lot of questions unless I need to know, you know. I was talking about that not long ago in our meeting about I did not know that I don't know is an answer. I didn't know that. I always thought that I had to know. And so somebody asked me a question, I always gave an answer. I mean, it didn't have to be based in truth or fact, you know. I'd be a wonderful politician, right? You just blather on, and if your bullshit is acceptable, they'll go, oh, okay. And I was pretty good at it. And one time, a friend called me down in AA and said, you don't know that. You are full of shit. And I'm like, I am. You're right. I didn't know that. So I use that phrase a lot. I don't know. You know, and people, they stop asking you questions, you know. If you say, I don't know enough, people just stop asking you shit altogether, you know. This guy doesn't know shit. Don't go to him for anything, you know. And so it really helped me curb my gossip. I had a penchant for gossip. We called it information in those days, but it's a defective character. It's called gossip. Did you hear about old what's-his-face? No. You don't know anything? I don't know. Okay, oh God. They just leave. So, I grew up in an Irish Catholic family, but again, I said I was an alcoholic, didn't I? So drinking was part, it's in the mosaic of our people. And my dad was an alcoholic. He was the most alcoholic person I knew. Now, granted, I didn't know that many people being a kid, but as far as I knew, he was the drunkest man at the parish picnic and always a tremendous embarrassment. And yet I love my dad. My dad was that classic alcoholic. I never had a kid that I knew in my life that didn't eventually say, God, I wish my dad was like your dad. So funny, so engaging, you know, and so drunk. And and he had that dual personality, you know. He'd be Chuckles the Magic Clown, you know, at the party. And then when we got in the car, he's like, now look, God damn it. You know, what the hell? Who's this guy? You know, oh, Dad's back. So it was, we never knew what to expect. You know, he sold insurance and hated it. He was very good at it because he was a people person, but he hated it. And so I grew up with that fear of, oh God, I don't want to grow up and do something like my dad does that's he hates. You know, now granted, he was an unrecovered alcoholic, but that's where I got that fear. Oh, and I think that's where if I stay too long in something, I'll end up like my dad. So I'd always quit these jobs. You know, people would start asking me probing questions, you know, wanting to get information, you know, like, what is your name? You know, things like women scared me a lot because they're like, who are you? You know, oh, you're the new guy. And I just wanted to be left alone. Can I just live in this cubicle for a number of hours and just be left the hell alone? And I'll just go home. Let's never have something personal. Ever. That was why I had trouble in AA. Want to go have coffee? No, never. I don't ever want to have coffee with anybody. And I don't mean you no harm. It's nothing personal, really, ever. And but for the people of Alcoholics Anonymous, I wouldn't be here. You know, they grabbed me and took me along, and I didn't have the courage to say, for whatever reason, because they were so nice. I don't want to go. I would think it, you know. But I got drug along and they asked me about my story, you know. And which needed to be told, you know. And they never asked me to speak. Because I had a story that needed to be told. But for some weird reason, nobody ever wanted to hear it. And I found out later it's because you have nothing to report. You know, we don't want what you have. You know, nothing personal, but we don't want what you have. If crazy was the order of the day, you're up. But no. I was real, real angry, too, when I got here. I was pissed off at the world for not delivering the life that I had imagined for myself. And, you know, one of the things I discovered, I thought about this later, is my dad bought me a utility shed. And it's not every child's dream, but it was mine. And it was like a big erector set, and I just made this thing up. And the reason he bought me is that I had taken up the hobby of magic. And so my brother, who's an alcoholic, loved to antagonize the shit out of me, just for fun and for free. And he'd go, I know how that trick works, you know. He'd get in my stuff. And I put my magic cape over my bookshelf where I kept all my stuff, and he'd lift up the cape, and it just made me crazy. And so my dad bought me this shed, which I constructed in the backyard, and that became my little magic kingdom. It literally became a way out of my house. Now, granted, I was only 6 or 10 feet away, but somehow getting out of that house and finding my own little world, which now we call isolation. I didn't know that then, but I loved isolation. Oh my God. I'd stay out there from 8 or 9 in the morning to 8 or 9 at night. I just loved magic so much. And my mom would have to come get me, coming in, you know. Oh, you know, they'd have to come get me to eat. So I loved it, and I had to put a lock on that thing, you know, no more brother problems on the magic front. So that was the beginning of a long passion with magic, and I'll tell you why I started drinking. The long and the short of it is there were six kids, well, seven if you count my dad. And my mom was the one parent, and my dad was... Anyway, they stayed together. People don't do that anymore. It's called divorce. But in those days, at least she married for life. So there were six kids. And my youngest sister got sick. Nobody knew why. What happened? Anyway, she was... The long and the short of it is that over the course of 2 years, we discovered that she had a brain tumor and a series of operations, which was really difficult for the family, one of which blinded her. And she was able to go back and continue swimming. They coached her as a blind swimmer. And she went back to school, learned Braille. I mean, she was this amazing little trooper. And eventually she passed away in our home. My parents brought her home. But I'm telling you, I was about 14 when all that started, and 16 by the time she passed away. And that's when I started drinking. I just could not handle it. And I don't know about my sisters, you know, but I know my brothers and I, two older brothers, three younger sisters, now two, we just checked out. We did whatever we did to not deal with the situation as best we could. And that day she passed away, you know, was in our back room. And I'm telling you, I didn't know what... I knew what wailing was, but I'd never seen a human being really wail. I mean, when you see your mother wail over the death of her youngest child, it's life-altering, you know. And my dad said, "Tim, go in and call the school." And I was frozen, you know. It was like that, you know, on TV when they put the cover over the person's face on the gurney. Hit me like a ton of bricks. I just knocked me out. And I couldn't speak on the phone. I was shocked to even ask me, how am I supposed to talk? And everybody knew what was going on. And so I called him and told him. I was able to finally, after a long pregnant pause, I told him my sister died today. And I think the funeral was on a Friday. She died like on a Tuesday, Wednesday, something like that. And that Friday night was the opening of a play at high school that I was one of the stars of. And I had to give this long speech about death. And everybody's like, "Oh God, we got to cancel the play. It's not going to happen." And my dad had said to me that morning, you know, as alcoholic as he was, you know, he had such great heart. You know, my mom kind of lived in her mind, and my dad kind of lived in her heart. And together they were kind of one person, you know. They made it work. And he said to me, "You know what? Maybe now your sister Maggie can see the play. You go tonight, you do that play, and you do the best you can." And I did. And the curtain opened, and you could hear a pin drop. And I gave this speech. And I got through it, you know. This is the first time I ever learned in my life that I could get through something major. I learned that Alcoholics Anonymous later, too. It doesn't matter what happens, you can get through it. You know, fear is a mile high and a mile wide, and it's paper thin. And suiting up and showing up is massively important. And you just kind of have to leave the rest to God. And I got through that speech, and yet my drinking did not deteriorate, did not diminish. I was on a run, you know, and I dropped out of college, and a friend came home one day. I was working. He was a raging alcoholic, and three of us were living in this apartment, and he said, "I quit my job today." And I said, "So did I." And he said, "What are we going to do?" And he said, why don't we move to California? I said, that's a great idea. We didn't have a car, but I mean, what an idea, you know. We didn't have any money, but God, what an idea, you know. So, you know, when you're young and stupid and stuff like that, you just don't know what you don't know. And so we had a garage sale and sold everything we had. And then we had to go to work about this car business. We had another friend who was another alcoholic. And we started in on him, you know. Hey, listen, we're going to California. You want to go with us? Oh, no, I got this great job at the Sheraton. I work the front desk. Oh, come, you're going to be left out. We're going. I mean, we're going to the ocean. That's where they draw the line, you know. We're going. So we worked on him about 2 weeks, and he's like, I got to give notice. It's like, people don't give notice. This is 1983. Come on, you know. So we talked him into it. We just got in the truck and left, you know, like the Beverly Hillbillies. We just packed it all up and headed due west. And we didn't have any kind of a plan. What a wonderful experience, you know. What are your plans? I don't know. Just driving. Got here, found a little half-bedroom apartment. I don't know if you know what a half-bedroom apartment is, but it was a small room on the way to the bathroom. And that's what happened. I took that one. I have control issues. And I was able to command that role of the half-bedroom party. And we kept drinking and using. You know, we always had plenty of party and plenty of booze, but never had the rent. The rent was $265 between three people. Never had it. Boy, we had a lot of party. And finally, things got so bad. We were doing extra work in the movies, you know. And things got so bad, we finally had to get a job, you know. And the dreaded job. I never wanted a job in my life. Because I had seen what it had done to my father, you know. It was just a source of misery. And then this boyfriend of mine got sober. And now, I had heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I that was it. To me, it was like Future Farmers of America, you know. I know what it is by the title, but I don't have any experience with this, you know, animal husbandry and whatever else they do there. And it was foreign. It was foreign to me. But he had gotten sober, and he got a DUI, and I didn't pay attention until that one day. And he had a sponsor, and the sponsor somehow hooked me up so I could go to these Spouses Anonymous or whatever it's called, or Al-Anon, and thank you. and that's how it all started. You know, and that is 29 years ago. You could have knocked me over with a feather had you told me, you know, 25 or 29 years later, you'll still be in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you'll be living in Fresno. I mean, I could see me sober before I'm living in Fresno. Come on, you know. That's fathomable, but not the other. But I've stayed willing to do whatever it has taken, you know. You know, I've learned that laughter is such a great healer, you know, and that's why, I mean, we learned something called Rule 62. Do you know what Rule 62 is? I didn't either. Yeah. About year three. No, I'm just kidding. I'll tell you right now. It's basically we don't take ourselves so seriously anymore, you know. And because we're, a lot of us, I'm not speaking for you, are full of shit. And we don't know our ass from third base. We learn to laugh, you know. The beautiful thing about laughter is you cannot laugh and think at the same time. Can't do it. So every time you laugh, you're getting a respite from you, you know. And frankly, some of us need the vacation, you know. I'm always amazed at people that come in here with a lot of time. A lot of time. I don't want to hear any of this newcomer bullshit. wrong location, go somewhere else, you know. I'm not, you know, I don't understand those people, you know. I was talking, Savannah and I were talking, and I was bitching about something. Savannah is my life partner, if you haven't picked that up already. He said, well, remember Route 66? I was like, okay, I speak a little Savannah. Let me sort this out. You mean Rule 62? He's like, well, yeah. You know. So we call it Route 66. You got to take Route 66 all the way. Because what you figure out along the way here is that, you know, you kind of get the joke. God has a wonderful sense of humor, you know. If you think they're laughing at you, they are. They are. Life is a joke and you are the punchline, you know. Not all the time, but many times. And, if you don't know how to laugh, oh man, it's a painful life, you know. Savon packed a lot into 10 minutes. He sure did. And one of the things we do is as you told me X number of years ago, it's a long process. We pray together. I have a schedule that lends itself to me being at home. I work at home. And he's in between jobs. And so we pray together in the morning, you know, and it's a lot. I mean, I'm usually, you know, hey, thank you. Talk to you later. You know, keep up the good work. That'll hold me for a week. I'm good, you know. Put together, and I gave him this prayer ritual for people in AA. And we basically take a little inventory. What are our defects of character? We pray for others. And lastly, we pray for ourselves. And we take the first three steps. I mean, it's a boom, boom, boom. We'd say the third step, seventh step. But I mean, it'll take us 30, 45 minutes sometimes. Savon likes to pray. He's a prayer. You know, nobody gets left out, you know. And so it's like, can you just say everybody, you know. He really takes this thing very seriously. And I can always tell my level of whatever, relaxation, spirituality, ease, fill in the blank, at my resistance level. It's like, oh, I don't want to pray. You know, it's when I need to pray. And when I'm like, God, that barely took any time at all. You know, it's like, well, that was 35 minutes. So, but I've been told that in the word spiritual is another word called ritual. And so we take the ritual each morning that makes us more spiritual. In my estimation, spirituality is just finding a way to be closer to God, to have a God consciousness, you know. Consciousness is being awake, you know. You know, it's an interesting word choice on step two. Came to believe. Everybody knows what came to me. I mean, we do. Yeah, we don't wake up. I kind of came to, and I made another point. You know, and I love that phrase we use. You're gonna hear a lot of. We have a phrase for everything. We do, and but they dissect those first three words of step two, which is we came, and then we came to, and then we came to believe. Which is a wonderful way to say it, you know. I mean, this is a simple program. I remember when they said that all the time. I didn't find it simple, you know, because they had 12 steps and 12 traditions. It seems like a lot of black and white for a simple program. And simple. But it is, you know. What makes it difficult is us, you know. When I was in my first few years, and I love AA because it doesn't say like some other spiritual pathways that, hey, this is it. You need look no further. This is the answer to everything. And I love that it says, no, please continue your work. Continue seeking. It's in the seeking, you know. It's always in the seeking. And so go out If you need physical, I mean, therapy, whatever kind, the psychotherapy, whatever it is, keep going. Do the work. Love that. You know? So I read this book called The Road Less Traveled by Scott Peck. Great book. I say great book. I don't know. I never read it. I read the first sentence on the first page of that book. Changed my life. I opened that book up and it said, life is difficult. Holy shit, that's incredible. I did not know. I didn't know that life was difficult. I really did not know. I knew life was difficult for me. It was painful. It was hideous. I didn't care for it. I had no skills. I get depressed. If only I felt up to committing suicide, I just don't feel up to it, you know? If I only had the energy, you know, I'd do away with myself. And so when I, you know, the phrase is here, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We heard it in our reading this morning. I never heard those three words put together. I heard them separately, but never put together. And boy, what a picture that painted. There was one morning when I was slithering out from underneath some person that was asleep, some creature, some animal, you know. It was an error in judgment at one point. And if I can just slither out of here without waking this beast. And walked into the I didn't know where I was. Was or how I got there or where my car was, and there was this rather large woman in the living room. Okay, I'll just say it's just big lesbian, and staring at me like an angry rhino, you know. And it was like, I gotta get out of here. I mean, she looked at me and I looked at her. It was like two ships passing in the night, you know. Just get out of here. And it took me a while to figure out where my car was, but God Almighty, I just thought, how have I ever? I got it, you know. Boy. Not completely, because I didn't get sobered the next day, but I that image came to mind when I heard that phrase. And there's so many memories when we talk that I think I never want to go back to that. You know, that's why if you're new, we tell the newcomer they're the most important person in the room. Now, you already knew that, but we have a different reason. Because you're fresh from the trenches. You know, when you speak, it reminds us of from whence we came. And that perhaps we never ever want to go back there. You know, they say that the newcomers are the lifeblood of the program. And they are. The old timers are the heart of the program. But the heart without blood ceases to exist. So we need you. We require you. So the store's always open, you know. If ever, and I'll tell you this, like they told me, if ever you change your mind, you go back out and do some controlled drinking or whatever, you get to decide. But that door is always open. You know, you can remember at any time. You're always welcome here. And I forgot I was an alcoholic a couple times. That's called a slip. And I don't know. I mean, my life was, that's the cunning and baffling and powerful part about this disease. My life was miserable. Nobody, no drunk, having received enough misery, darkens that door of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the end of the road, you know, and comes here and stays here for a number of days or weeks, and then goes out there, and when they're offered a drink, like I was, takes it without thinking, unless there's something else going on other than just forgetting. They do call it the disease of forgetting. And that happened to me twice. I'm like, Jesus, I can't even, how could I forget I'm an alcoholic? I've been going to this thing for 90 plus days, you know. And so I deserved those 90 day chips. I mean, even though I'd slipped, I took some chips because damn it, I'd earned it, you know. I had stayed for the miracle, and so I had these chips, and who was to know, you know. And so I kept going, and I had almost at 90 days again. Sure enough, somebody offered me something, and without thinking, damn it, I'm a future farmer of America, and I forget it, you know. And I was really mad. I'm like, what is wrong with me? You know, the answer is you're an alcoholic, you know. So I remember there was this wonderful, wonderful old timer in AA named Anthony Ivory. And he was a portly Englishman. And as a young man, he'd served on the Queen Mary. And he'd been a steward. And I mean, he was just such a character. And he'd say, Tim, I want to see you take your 90-day chip. And I was, oh, okay. I can't wait either. Is it Wednesday night? I think so. So I was like, I hope he doesn't come. I mean, I was going to take it, but I didn't want him to be there for it. And sure enough, he was, Tim, I'm here to see you take your chip. And I was like, God damn it. So I was torn. You know, what do you do when you're a liar and a cheat and a thief and you want a chip? You know, you get up and you take one. And I did. Now, for whatever reason, I had three other chips in my pocket, my other chips. Those I had actually earned. I had slipped after 90 days, but I don't know what I was going to do. I didn't know what I was going to do until I did it. This is the miracle of sobriety, because somehow this program gets in. You know, if we keep showing up, it kind of ekes into our existence. And they held up the chip, and, you know, we'd all line up, and handed me a chip, and I said, my name is Tim, and I'm an alcoholic. And I said, I'm not going to take this chip. For one simple reason, I don't have 90 days. I slipped. And in fact, I'm going to give back these chips that I already have. And I handed all four chips to the secretary. And, you know, yeah, they clap you off or whatever they do. A lot of clapping in West Hollywood. We go, oh, look at you. You're the coffee person? Oh, wow. Fantastic. I love the coffee. And if people are not from there, they're like, what is going on? You know, it's like the Academy Awards, you know. But it's a lot of show business folks there, you know. So, anyway, it was a wonderful place to get sober. And after the meeting, the secretary came up to me and said, thank you for being so honest, you know. That chip I gave you was the last 90-day chip I had. And there were three other people behind me, or four, and had you not given me the chips you had, I would have been short. I would not have had those chips for those people. And so that got my attention, too. That was a little God shot. You know, oh, that's interesting. A lot of coincidences happen here, you know. What else can I tell you? When I moved to Los Angeles, so the buddy that I moved to, the alcoholic I moved to Los Angeles with, was also an actor. You know, we were going to be in the movies. We were one of some of those people. We were going to be famous. And we did. We were background. There I am. We'd watch the film. You know. A lot of lingering in the back, you know. So sometimes they're just, stop! Cut! That extra in the back, would you please move out of the frame, you know? So, oh, me? Okay. Because the film was about us. It's just Robert Blake was in the foreground, you know? And so, anyway, I was also, I had done magic in college, and I'd done it. I started to do it for part of my living. And When I got to, I was really freaked out by, you know, Los Angeles. I mean, it's just a major, major place to move. And Oklahoma City is not Springville, but it's also not Los Angeles, you know. So, anyway, we just kind of went about and did our thing. You know, we were mesmerized by the place. And I finally decided to, you know, I always got good feedback about my magic. And so I went to, I didn't know what else to do. I looked up one of those agencies. You look in the yellow. In those days, kids, we had things called yellow pages. And you actually had, it's like a hard copy kind of a thing. And so I, because someone had told me, a therapist had said, this wonderful woman had said, what did you used to like to do when you were a kid? And I said, well, I did this magic thing. And she let me talk for 15, 20 minutes. And she said, you got to go back and do that. Well, I said, no, I mean, I don't do that anymore, but I'm, you know, wait, no, you have got to go back and do that. And I said, why? Because she said, because your face lights up when you talk about it. And I didn't know, because one person had said one negative thing. I had auditioned at one place and heard someone, you know, ready for this, thought I was a shitty magician. Now, it only takes one person to convince me that I'm a complete piece of shit, you know. 99 other loving, wonderful people who hug me, but the one person that says you're a real turd, you know. I'm crushed. I'm out of here. I should cease just living. I'm done, you know. And I packed it all the way. I'm out, you know, because if there's something you love, give it up. Give it up, you know. Because someone said one thing against you. You know, that was the level of skill I had, the level of self-esteem. And I couldn't bear to part with my stuff. But it was part of my life. I'd worked in a magic shop as a demonstrator. I had done all these wonderful things. All this, everything went out the window. It's kind of like us and our alcoholism, you know. What happened? I don't know. I just forgot everything. You know, we're off on another tear, you know. So in this therapy session, she said, well, go. I mean, just make a couple of calls. I'm like, oh, Jesus. I got to shut this woman up. She kept asking every week, got on this thing. How's it going with your calls? None. I don't want to, just make a couple calls. She, by the way, she was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Changed my life. And she shared with me privately that, you know, it's great to see some success in my work. Because there's a lot of people that I see here that just don't, people want to talk about it, but they don't actually want to change, you know. And here, the proof is in the pudding. I mean, we do the work here. It's super difficult to stay here. You know, if you're not willing to grow, I want to remain the same. It's hard. I mean, you don't have to work the steps. That is a big secret, too. Some people don't work the steps. I don't know why. They just don't. But you can stay sober on service and meetings. You know, meetings give us balance, and service gives us a measure of recovery, but no lasting change. You know, if you want to actually change the inside job, the stuff, it's all laid out in order. You just start with one, and you go to two, and then three. I mean, it's numbered, and people do the, you know, it's called the AA wall. So 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. You know, what about four? No. I remember I had a sponsee and we were having trouble. Yeah, I said, we need to get on with that fourth step. And he said, no. And I said, why? He said, it's just not me, you know. You're on to something there. It's nothing like you, you know. It's why I'm suggesting that. It's everything you drank over. Why would you want to sit on that? You know, unless you just have a high threshold of pain. So if your big secret is, well, I worked the steps when I got here in 72, we continue to take personal inventory. I don't know if what I know of that word continued is ongoing. You know, and that's another thing. I was trying to get somebody to secretary a meeting. You know, I did that when I was new. But you're 30 years sober. You know, that's a newcomer thing. No, it's not. It's a comer thing. You know, it's an AA thing. Back to me. Me. So I took some action. I'm going to make a phone call. I went to the Yellow Book, Yellow Pages. I looked up, I don't know, about the third or fourth one, Devro Entertainment Agency. That sounds like good as any. I called the guy up. Oh, God, the guy was a total codger. I mean, he sounded like, you know, the classic agent sitting behind the desk, you know, with the cigar, you know. Hey, stick with me, kiddo. I'll make you a star. And Bill Devro. So he said, hi, my name is... I gave the lamest pitch. I kind of used to do this thing, and I'm thinking about maybe kind of... Could you mumble a little louder? You know. So he was not impressed. I was thrilled to get this phone call done so I could report back to this woman. I made the phone call. Get off my ass. Nothing will occur. And he said, well, I got pages and pages of magicians. By the way, I use that on him later. You got pages and pages of magicians, right? You can find another one. He said, okay, well, I just want to make the lame-ass phone call. And I was just about to get off, and he said, well, give me your, what's your name and number? So I gave my name and my number, and that was it. Oh, thank God. And I was able to report back to her. I made the phone call. They don't want me. It's going to work out well. And within 3 weeks, he called me. Never saw my ex. This was the level of quality that he sent out, you know. It was really a rent-a-pony, rent-a-clown, rent-a-magician. You got a magic trick or two? Okay, get the suit. And he said, okay, I got a gig for you. You do? I didn't have the wherewithal to say, I haven't practiced my shit in 14 years. I don't know what the hell I'm doing. I was just kidding, you know. So, it's in Van Nuys. It's a 6-year-old birthday party. The kid's name is... Okay. And oh yeah, one more thing. You got a wizard suit? Well, no. Oh yeah, all the guys are wearing them. Well, I didn't know. I've been out of the game for 14 years, so I knew costumers in Hollywood. I'll get one of those suits, and I could literally suit up and show up. And so I did. I called my friend. I showed up. I was terrified. Absolutely. I felt like a 6-year-old myself. I'm 5'8", and this suit was built for a 6'2" person. So I was dragging it, you know, like a Renaissance dress or something, you know. And the hat was that pointy thing, and it's like, what the hell am I doing? But I had enough sobriety. I said, you know what? I'm just going to pretend like I'm here with my family or my AA friends in this backyard, and I'm just going to be afraid. And I'll just do the best I can. I'd learn, just do the best you can. You know, I had a coffee commitment. I was terrified of it when I first got sober in those days. The commitment was a year. It's like, I was terrified of the commitment, you know. Oh, my God. I knew what coffee was. I drank coffee. I'd had coffee. I loved coffee. But I was terrified. I said, well, what if I don't make it right? And my wonderful friend Jim said, you won't make it right. Okay. These are alcoholics, okay? It's going to be too hot. It's going to be too cold. You should start it later. Maybe you start it earlier, okay? It's too weak. It's too strong. You know, a lot of suggestions, okay? Make the coffee anyway. And I showed up scared. You know, in those days, I was working as a waiter in this private dining room at Bear Stearns. They're gone now. that was my first job in sobriety. And I, from there, I'd learned how to show up scared. I wasn't a good waiter, you know. Oh, God. But they kept me. They kept me, you know. The one day, the soup of the day was a gazpacho. And I said it was Gestapo soup, you know. I don't know what to do. And it was a big Jewish guy, you know. I don't know. God. But they were like, you're just a terrible waiter, but we're going to keep you anyway. And so after that job, I would go to the, we called it the drive-by meeting because it was 45 minutes. I know it's a long time to sit for new people, but it was 45 minutes, you know, drive up, get some sobriety and drive off. And I made that coffee and I started feeling a part of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. So I knew how to suit up and show up and be afraid. And I start showing up for these parties. By the way, Bill Devereaux never saw my act for almost 1 year. And he was in Burbank, and I happened to do a party there, and he showed up. You're late! I know. And then one day he told me about 2 years in, he said, you know, I always get good reports on you. And, really? I mean, I never heard. So, I started getting shows on my own, and after a while, he'd call and he'd say, are you available for the 16th? And I'd say, no, I actually have a gig already. Ah, you're booking your own stuff, huh? Big shot now. Oh, yeah. No, I'm just booking my own shit. And so, anyway, today I... what moved me to Fresno was magic, you know. I had I just was in a weird place. I mean, I didn't discover my passion for magic, rediscover it, until I was 9 years sober. So I was one of those people shuffling through that door, you know, is this all there is? Yeah, good to see you too. You know, I was just still had that kind of jaded quality. And, that was a miracle. I rediscovered that. Today, what my job is, and sometimes I forget and I say that I work for myself, but today God is my employer. My day job is I go out to schools and I give an educational assembly program. Sometimes it's on reading, science, math, to try and get kids interested in science and technology and things like that so that they can work and not go to prison. I don't know. But a guy books me. I mean, and sometimes I'm like, I don't know how you're going to pull this one off, you know. And I just have to be reminded that I am not in charge. I have a God of my own understanding. I was able to redefine my definition of God and find one that worked for me. I didn't have a lot against the church. I just didn't have a lot for it. You know, a lot of times they didn't include people of my ilk, and it showed. And so I just said, well, good for you. I'm going to go over here. And I happened to find this wonderful spiritual path called Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new, the good news is that it's a spiritual program. And the bad news is that it's a spiritual program. And because some of us have a very old definition, you know, and we have to redefine that and uncover and discover and discard, you know. And I still have those layers of the onion that are coming off, you know. I got a mom that has dementia now, you know, and I'm able to find the blessing in every dark cloud now. You know, temporarily I have my setbacks, but the wonderful thing about her is all her dementia, I should say, it's allowed her to selectively forget all the painful, horrible things that went on in our house. There was a lot of violence. And, you know, we couldn't fight back, so we fought with each other, you know. But, and that brother that got sober, who's 30 years sober, has found it necessary to be estranged from all of us. I will tell you, though, he does go to Alcoholics Anonymous once or twice a year, whether he needs it or not. Now, it doesn't seem to work as well for him because he's estranged from us, including his mom. I don't know how you discover that at 25 years of sobriety, you're mad at your mommy, but it's a cunning and baffling and powerful disease. And it was particularly painful to her, given that she didn't do anything. recently he visited her, and she has no recollection of it, even an hour later. So the visit was really for him. And but I'm so great. She's so happy now. She has fellowship with other people. I mean, the wonderful thing is they don't remember anything. Not even the fight they had. My mom has always been pretty competitive, and they play entirely too much bingo there. I'll tell you that. Okay? So she threw her card and her chips at her dear, dear friend for winning. And an hour or less later, neither of them remembered it. Yeah. That's the blessing. You're not amused, but they are, okay? So, but we had a time finding her a place, and we weren't sure. It was awful, because she was super unhappy, and that's just the way I choose to look at it, you know? She's like a fading sunset, and a sunset's a beautiful thing, if you take the time to look. You know, but you got to take time to look. You know, this is a wonderful spiritual journey inward. You know, and through service primarily, and the steps. If you're lucky, the further you go in, you'll forget yourself. That's the whole point, to forget you. Because when you can finally forget all of you, you'll find you, the true you. Another contradiction, you know. My sponsor who passed away, who sponsored me for almost 20 years, used to always say, you know, you're the best Tim you've ever been. And I knew he was right. He said another thing that was wonderful. He'd say, has anybody told you they love you today? And invariably I would say no. And he'd say, let me be the first. And I loved him. He taught me so much. And he taught me that you can't sponsor everybody the same way. Some people need a gentle touch. And other people need to be drop kicked through the goalposts, you know. They just do. You know, for the reason of the full of shitness I spoke of earlier, you know. They're deluded with self, you know. I never did anything wrong. What a statement from an alcoholic, you know. More will be revealed. That's another one of those statements we have, you know. And the layer of the onion comes off. I remember I was sitting in a meeting one day, and I looked at one of those signs. Oh my God, I saw it in a different way for the first time. I knew what does it. Easy does it. Easy does it. What does it? Easy does it. I just was so taken with that whole experience. It, apparently it was just a singular sensation, but I don't know. You see stuff from different angles, you know. I'll tell you one last story before I go. As I've kind of gone out in these schools, and by the way, I want to talk a little bit about Savant. I was a singular sensation for many years, and I was happy to be single, not because I was loving it, but because I was protecting myself. I'm done. My picker was busted. I don't know about you, but I would pick the twisted, the freaky, the damaged, the no return type of whack job, you know. Other than that, they were super awesome people, you know. But a lot of verbal abusers, because to me, that's what I knew, you know. My dad used to call me Timothy Turd, you know. It's a lovely name for a child. Unless you want to build a relationship, you know. A turd, everybody figures out later, is waste. It's not worth a lot. It's not really an endearing term. Otherwise, more parents would use it. And but that's, you know, again, I love my dad. I had no unfinished business because of AA. I was able to say, I will never hold back love from you. I did it to as payback. You were not the father I imagined for myself, and I will never do that to you again. And he told me he loved me, and that there was no problem. I had no unfinished business with him when he unexpectedly passed away. And that's the way I live today. I live pretty clean, unexpectedly, you know. And we were sitting around at Thanksgiving, 9 people at the table, 8 of them in recovery. Never happened in my family before. And the one that didn't have recovery is a 13-year-old boy that's never seen most of us drunk and hadn't taken a drink himself. That's a miracle for our clan. It is a one day at a time thing, you know. And I wish you and anybody like you a wonderful journey, you know. There's going to be times, life is difficult. It's freaking difficult. But I've heard old timers say, you know what, it doesn't matter what happens. Flip a coin. I can live with it either way, you know. And that's the skill set we get, you know. I still get disappointed. There's still shit I want. You know, but I told the kids at Thanksgiving, we were going around doing thankfuls. And I said, you know, the thing I'm really thankful for is that I have, if I went today, right now, I have no unfinished business. I have things I want to do, places I want to go, people I want to meet, but I have no regrets. Not one. I can look at my life and say, I became me. That's the goal, for you to become you. And yeah, I live a pretty clean life. I live a life of gratitude. You know, we practice gratitude because it goes out the window if we don't. And Alcoholics Anonymous has not only changed my life, it's saved my life and given me a life. And I really can honestly say that I love all of you. And thank you for being here. All right.